Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 74 of Season 10 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today on the 74th episode of a movie that came out in 1974 is Alan Sanders of The Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back, Alan.
Thank you so much. Great to be back here, buddy. Love talking about this movie and the fact that I discovered it thanks to you just a few weeks ago when I saw it before getting ready for these episodes.
Well, I'm glad. I'm always glad to be able to introduce people to movies that they should have seen many, many years ago, but now get the chance to enjoy it at in the present. You know, why not?
Can I tell you that because of this, I told my buddy at work, I do a radio show, a morning drive to work radio, and one of his all-time favorite movies, which is also a Robert Shaw film, is The Sting. And I have never in my life seen The Sting.
Really?
And I had not. I have now, because as of over the weekend, I decided this past weekend to watch that flick, and I forgot to share that with you. But I am now all caught up on another Robert Shaw flick.
Does that mean you need to go back to Tuesday's episode and change your
No, your I don't think up? I would change my listing of Robert Shaw performances. This may sound bad. I didn't find Robert Shaw's character in that to be particularly a standout role compared to the other ones we talked about.
Okay. That's fair.
Completely. I mean, I felt like he was the bad guy and he was going to be, you know, the guy that he was going to be played for the, you know, they were basically trying to pull the sting on him and try to take him for all he's worth. But he felt more flat and stock as a bad guy. It was more about watching them try to pull this off.
Right. Okay. Fair. There was a rumor a few years ago that that Jim O'Kane wanted to use that as, do another group project with that one. But apparently it never came to be.
It fell through, yeah. So I would have watched The Sting to get ready for that at that time because I remember that as a possibility. And it's one of those movies that it's not like I didn't want to see it. It just always skipped my radar. So.
Okay. Yeah, it's got so many great actors in that movie. Harold Gould in that.
Well, I remember some of the guys. I remember like the guy, I can't remember his last name, Dana something, but I remember he was on Baa Baa Black Sheep. Obviously,
Charles Durning is in it. Ray Walston. I'm thinking of Ray Walston.
My favorite Martian, and of course
you're talking about Dana Elkar. Wasn't Dana Elkar? Wasn't he in? He was MacGyver, wasn't he? Wasn't he in MacGyver?
I don't know. I never watched MacGyver as a show.
I'm pretty sure he was like someone in MacGyver. Yeah, he was in. He was 126 episodes of MacGyver. Yeah. I guess that sort of means that he was on the show. Mm-hmm. Just 126 episodes. What's that between friends, right? All right. So minute 74 begins with Frank continuing to complain and ends with Green starting his next mission. So we ended things yesterday with the trio. Basically, we spent all day yesterday with the trio of Rico, Garber. Yeah, I'm now quoting you when you call him Garber, and Daniels, as they were trying to brainstorm to try and figure out what actually these guys are trying to do. We ended things yesterday with Garber saying to Rico that he needs to he's a sick man. Yeah, and then we hear in the background Frank. He gets up and he's talking on a different radio, and he goes, "For Christ's sakes, what do you want me to do? The power's still off. They'll have to move them by bus." What do you mean you haven't got any buses? Go ahead and hijack some. which is a great first of all, it's a great way to show it that how he's venting his frustration and stuff like that with the way that he does all these things. And I've always liked Frank. I think he's a great character. He really fits in here as the guy who's the no-nonsense guy trying to run the control station. He is the train master. And, It's just funny that he just says to someone on the phone, you know, well, if you can't find any buses, just go out and hijack some.
You're right. So considering they're in the middle of being hijacked themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he turns towards Garber and goes, hey, Garber, what's going on? Do I get my trains back now or don't I, huh? And he goes, you don't, not yet. He goes, Jesus, do you realize the goddamn rush hour starts in an hour? And he turns to him and goes, will you shut up for a minute and listen to me? Because I got a new set of instructions. He goes, I don't give a rat's ass for your instructions. I'm not lifting a finger to help the killers of Gaz Dalowitz. And at this point, Garber gets a little bit upset. And he rushes over to him and picks him up. And then Garber says to him, now you listen to me, you dumb son of a bitch. If you don't do what I tell you, you'll be having dinner tonight with Gaz Dalowitz. And he like pushes him back and he falls and misses the chair and the chair falls down with him and stuff like that. And he goes, Jesus Christ, what are you? So it's an interesting way to show the difference between, you know, what Garber needs to do here and what Frank's trying to do. Frank, as far as he's concerned, wants to, you know, he just wants to get back to work. But this hijacking is not allowing him to do that in the proper way that he wants to.
Well, I do like, in general, just as a commentary of the rising tension and what leads to this bit of a physical interchange. This guy, yeah, I get it. I want my trains. I'm worried about commuters. I'm worried about passengers. I'm worried about keeping things running on time. But it's like he's so worried about the mechanics of keeping the trains on time, he's completely missing the fact that there are 30 or so lives, or maybe 20 lives, that are at risk. That the lieutenant here is like, I'm trying to save people, okay? I don't care if it's a little inconvenient that people can't catch their train. We need to save actual lives. And the fact that it builds throughout to the point where he is just sick and tired of hearing this blowhard spouting off as if somehow everyone doesn't have a as if their job isn't as important as his job. And like, oh my God, you're keeping me from the trains and the commuter and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, will you just shut up? I just love that.
Did you notice his accent? He goes, you shut up.
Shut up.
Shut up.
It's such a great release because I was getting frustrated with this guy because I'm like, do you not have any empathy for the fact that there are actual human lives at stake? I get you're trying to keep the city running and I understand it's an inconvenience, but so is a traffic jam. You've got lives at stake, and he's trying to make it seem like that's secondary to moving the trains on the right schedule.
Correct.
And so I actually really enjoyed this, and I will tell you from somebody who's been in theater and film and have acted and directed, I'm pretty sure that it was a mistake that he wasn't supposed to be like they hit the floor. I think that was a mistake, and they just kept it because it looks almost like he was thrown off his game because I think he was supposed to sit back in the chair and – the fact that he didn't is actually better.
Correct. Yeah, I do like the way that he like falls onto the ground there because also you're not expecting it because you also don't expect Garber to get so I don't know if violent is the right word, but but again and I mean Dick O'Neill's face when Garber is holding him, you know, close to him, he like closes his eyes tightly as if he's not used to something like this or whatever.
And then he looks all of a sudden, here's the guy, and I love this. This is usually, generally the boisterous bully is the first person to fold when somebody who's actually stronger and tougher gets in their face because his face turns into like a little kid being scolded.
Right.
Which is exactly what I thought. I'm like, because it's almost like he realizes, oh crap, I pushed this guy too far. And of the two of us, while I'm walking around acting like I'm the big guy in the room, you realize all of a sudden he's not.
Right. That's true. Now, I also like the fact that, I mean, going along with the idea that this was not planned, that he was supposed to fall on the floor, you see that one of the other actors next to him reaches out to lift him up.
You know, right away.
Right away, as if this is, you know, it was a spontaneous action, you know, not necessarily planned. So I think I'm going to agree with you on that this was, it was not meant this way.
But 100%.
But must have liked the way that it came out on film. And because his glasses are also like, the glasses like fall down in an awkward way on his face as he falls on the ground. You know, but again, if it's fake, then these are also great actors that they're able to continue acting despite something happening that's not supposed to happen.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, most of these folks have had some experience, and one of the things you learn in film is until you hear the word cut, you keep going. Unless you're a prima donna or you're one of those privileged A-list actors who has the ability to yell cut yourself, which I would never do on a set, you just keep going. You go until you hear cut. You just keep going. And I'm assuming they all knew that, but his reaction, like everything, just the first time I watched it and every time I've watched it since, I'm like, he was supposed to land in his chair. But the fact that the chair crashes, the fact that he hits the ground, his glasses come off, one guy reaches down, felt so much more real because I honestly think it was a real fall. And then it just becomes even more, you know, it hits you more that Garber is really at his wit's end with this knucklehead. He's like, just shut up.
That's right. Exactly. And once again, you know, in the part where Frank walks across the room, we get to once again see the continuity of the clock, that it is right. I it just amazes me so much that they were so good at this, of keeping the time, you know, proper on the clocks behind them as all this is going on. You know, even because the movie takes place over the period of just a few hours, but still to constantly get the clocks right is just amazing. So he mentions the fact that it's almost rush hour. Okay. What do you know about the term rush hour?
I know it's an oxymoron because you're not actually moving fast. But okay. I do think the idea of rush hour is the idea that everybody is trying to rush to get home at the same time or rush to wherever all at the same time, which the irony is because everybody goes at the same time, you're probably not going all that quickly.
Okay. So do you know when the term rush hour was coined?
Oh, no idea. In fact, I've heard that my whole life, so it's got to be earlier than the 70s.
Well, let's put it this way. It was starting to be used a century before you or I were born. That's how
far back it
goes. Yes. The first
Are you kidding me?
Nope. The first known use of it is 1863. In London.
Okay. What was rushing around besides people and carriages?
They had a railway at the time. They had an underground railway that they were using it. So the idea was that it was a term used to describe periods of peak commuter traffic.
Mm.
Okay, and it has nothing. It started off not dealing with cars. It originally referred to streetcars or railways and stuff like that, where that's the area where there are the most number of commuters. That's the time of day when there are the most amount of commuters, and therefore there's more congestion. And the rushing is the people are rushing because they have to get somewhere, but they can't get there because of all the traffic, as you said.
Yep.
You know, because everyone is rushing to get to one place, there's a lot more congestion and stuff like that. Already in the 1870s, it was put into the Oxford Dictionary as something that was being used. There are many different quotations from the 1880s in like Cincinnati that they're about streetcar traffic and stuff like that, and obviously. The Industrial Revolution only helped add to the problem of, you know, more people needing to use public transportation and more people getting stuck trying to go from one place to another. Obviously, once they started using cars, so that started making even more congestion at the same time because, you know, again, this is where everyone is trying to get to work. They're trying to get to where they need to go. And stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there you have rush hour in the morning when people are trying to get to work, and then you have rush hour in the afternoon when people are trying to go home. You know, that type of thing. There is also a term called internet rush hour. Do you have any idea what that could potentially mean?
Well, I'm going to guess if you I'm going to make an educated guess that peak times that people are online using the internet, which can cause then bottlenecks, and that's when the internet may seem slower or congested.
Exactly. Exactly. There is also what's known as the third rush hour. You have any idea what that means?
As it relates to the internet or as it relates to actual commuters?
No, as it relates to the original commute. I mean, we said there's the rush hour in the morning when people are going to work, the rush hour in the afternoon when people are going home from work, and then you have a third rush hour.
Third? I've never heard of the term third rush hour. Let me see if I can deduce. Holiday?
Nope, it's the period of midday where roads in urban and suburban areas become congested due to numerous people going out for lunch.
Oh, yeah, okay. Your lunch rush.
Exactly. When most people are going to restaurants and fast food locations and stuff like that, so they're then crowding the entrances to all these different places, which causes even more traffic congestion. There's probably like more congestion at the mall at that time. Yeah, but
the food court.
Yeah, exactly. What's funny is that I know you're from the Atlanta area, so Atlanta is actually shown on Wikipedia in a picture of rush hour.
Well, here's the ironic part. A lot of people always talk about how LA is so bad because you can spend an hour going, let's say, 10 miles. And that's what's frustrating because you're not going very far. But technically, Atlanta has a longer commute time because people live further out and you still run into rush hour. So I think Atlanta has surpassed LA as the longest or one of the longest rush hours that or average commute times people have being stuck in their car.
Right. Exactly.
Now here's the weird thing. Let me ask you this question. I'm going to ask you a question when it comes to rush hour.
Yeah, you can try.
in general, would you prefer an hour commute where you're only going 10 miles bumper to bumper, or an hour commute, but it's because you live so far out, you're at least driving somewhat normal speed, but it still takes an hour. In other words, which is worse for you, an hour in bumper to bumper for a 10-mile drive, or just an hour to get to work?
Well, let's put it this way. I do live an hour away from work. Mm-hmm. So it takes me at least an hour. And when there is traffic during rush hour, either in the morning or the afternoon, it can sometimes take me over 2 hours. Because I listen to podcasts and while I'm driving, I'm not as affected as most people because I also take into consideration that it will take me longer to get home or get to work, whatever the case may be.
If it's an hour, either one, let's just assume that the standard here is an hour.
I would prefer the hour, the hour commute itself without traffic.
Okay. That's exactly where I am. And my wife is the same way. She's like, I don't care how long it takes as long as I'm moving. What frustrates her is stop and go, stop and go, stop and go. The whole bumper to bumper. She goes bananas. And the commute could be 30 minutes. But if it's 30 minutes bumper to bumper, or she could take a side road and keep moving and it would take 45, she'd rather take 45 to get to her destination, or at least she's moving, than to be stuck in stop-go traffic.
Right. Okay. I can agree with that. But again, I'm used to both. So depending on what time I leave to go to work or come home from work, and obviously every day is a crapshoot because you don't know if there's going to be, an accident or something along the way that will change things.
Right. Yeah. Well, the funny part on this is that perception. It's still faster to stay in the bumper to bumper, but she hates being stuck in that mode. In her mind, at least I'm moving. It feels like I'm getting there faster, even when you're technically not. She just doesn't like being stuck.
Okay. Again, I can understand that, but for me, it doesn't matter either way. Okay. I don't get frustrated sitting in traffic, unless I'm on my way somewhere where I need to be there by a certain time. And even if I've given myself ample, flex time and that still didn't work. I mean, I can even remember about a year and a half ago, my wife and I were going, we wanted to go to a show that it was a little over an hour drive and there was so much traffic. It took us 2.5 hours to get there and we missed the show because of that. And she didn't talk to me for 3 days because it's obviously my fault. I know we've discussed this. Obviously it was my fault. that we, you know, that even if we took 2 hours to get somewhere that takes us an hour and we still got stuck in traffic, it's my fault. But whatever.
Now, water on a similar note, but my wife didn't get mad because she was with me. But on a similar note, we have learned in our age of technology, because we went to a friend's house that was just about a 30-minute drive down the interstate from where we live. And it was the weekend, and we never thought to put the address into GPS. We know how to get there. It's the weekend. It was Saturday. We've learned our lesson. We jumped on the interstate, and all of a sudden, just as we joined with all the traffic, nothing but red lights, all lanes blocked. Turns out that there had been a bad accident about 20 minutes earlier, had blocked all lanes. We were trapped for 2 hours. Had we punched in the GPS just to check before leaving, we would have known and we could have taken an alternative route, but we got stuck for 2 hours because we didn't pay attention to the GPS. So it doesn't matter. We always punch it in now just in case there is that accident that has the interstate blocked.
Well, yeah, I always put it into GPS anyway, just for the sake of hoping that I'm not going to get stuck somewhere.
No.
It doesn't always work.
We learned our lesson. We were like, oh no. And we had to keep telling them, like, cause they had made dinner and we're like, sorry, go ahead and eat with us. Like, no, we'll keep it warm. And of course we got there and it was all dry and we're like, no, sorry. We still had a good time, but it was just 2 hours delayed.
Oh wow. That sucks.
Yeah. We were literally trapped for 2 hours. We were just like, well, what do you want to do?
It gave you quality time to sit and talk.
Yeah.
Isn't that what you needed?
Anyway. All right. Sorry. I didn't mean to derail, but we were talking rush hour.
That's great. We're letting people learn a little bit about our history.
Mm-hmm.
We continue and we're now back on the train itself. The hostages are trying to figure out what's going on as the power comes on. And Blue then turns to Green and goes, okay, better take the case out. And he goes, all right. And he picks up, a big metal case, which, we'll have to wait. We'll have to wait and find out what's in that case. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and this goes to my earlier comment as well. We once again, while this minute is winding down, it's Mr. Blue's turn for us to watch for about 20 seconds, him stuffing wads of cash into his vests and his pockets before zipping up.
Right.
So I think we've seen pretty much everybody on camera for however long it was going to take to just stuff wads of cash into their vests and pockets and zip up.
Well, I the truth is I like the way that they do that because, you know, it's to establish that as far as we're concerned, everyone has, you know, picked up their money that they're supposed to be holding on to. You know, again, it goes back to our conversation from the other day. Are they holding it on to it for themselves? Or are they holding on to it to go somewhere? That doesn't matter either way. You know, here it's just the idea everyone is equal from that perspective. Blue doesn't really trust Mr. Gray. He's still willing to let him hold on to a quarter of the loot,
mm-hmm.
which is great.
It's also different in the sense that as an audience watcher, because my first thought, and I, you know, we talked about it a couple of days ago, but why didn't they just have a duffel bag or a briefcase or something? And then, you know, we'll learn later. Maybe there's a reason why we're spending so much time with their costume, if you will, or their manner of dress.
Correct. Yeah. I think about 3 weeks, we'll talk about that. We'll figure out why they need to have such elaborate costumes with pockets.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you wonder.
You do ask yourself. I will tell you, as a movie watcher, I did find myself because I was like, why are you spending so much time with this? This is like boring. Okay, I get it. They're stuffing their money. It does play later, and you may have to wonder with that audience and again filmmaking of that day, were they trying to make it kind of obvious to people that there was more to this scene than just watching him stuff money?
Exactly, and it works because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes you wonder. Like, why are they doing this? As opposed to what you said, why don't they just carry the bag, you know, whatever. But now we understand why.
Well, definitely do by the end of the movie.
Right. Well, again, it's because it's all planned out so perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
even from that perspective. And I love the fact that Green once again sniffles as he grabs the, you know, the metal case, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Once again, reminding us that this guy is, has a cold. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that's going to come up later, but who knows?
I can tell you this, and this is something that my kids have always commented on with me, and I think they'll get to the point when they've seen enough movies, they'll be able to do it. But as a movie watcher, I immediately knew there was going to be something about the plot that had to do with him sneezing and or his cold. Something about it. Now, whether it was going to cause a problem because he falls asleep, whether it causes a problem because he gives away their position, I didn't know, but you could tell they were intentionally putting focus on the sneeze and the sniffles. And they wanted you to be reminded of that throughout, as if that was not part of the planning. That was something that they hadn't expected to have happen.
Well, okay, since now I can ask you this question. Since you've never had seen the movie before, and in all of the emails and conversations that we've had before you watched the movie and knew what we were talking about, what the hell did you think I was talking about when I kept saying that the tagline is Gesundheit?
I had no idea. But I've been working with you long enough that I don't know what you're going to ask half the time, so I just nod and agree.
Okay. All right, that works.
So I had no idea, having had never seen it before, but as a movie watcher, I was like cued right away. I'm like, that's going to be important. I don't know how, but I'm going to keep my eye on why they're calling into attention that he said, I didn't know where I picked this up. I called it a cold, kept sneezing. And then you had Gesundheit a couple of times from Walter Matthau from Garber. So I was like, this is important. It's going to come into play somewhere.
And it did.
Yes, it did.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say about this particular minute?
No, I think we got it. It's I like, and by the way, thank you for this week. And I know we've got another one coming, but it's a nice continuation of one kind of overall scene in the movie.
Well, I spoke to the people making the movie 51 years ago, and I told them that I'm going to be doing a show like this and that you should really plan things out properly so that when we get a week that I'm going to have a particular guest on, you know, that things are going to be done the right way.
Well, I thank you, sir. That was very nice. I'm glad the DeLorean worked for you. You could go back and tell him this stuff beforehand.
Yes, I'm glad to. All right. So every Thursday we have a segment called 70s Trivia Potpourri. Where we're going to test your movie trivia of the 1970s.
As so, we know, it was very weak.
Well, so we're going to find that out shortly. We're going to have five questions for you, so we'll see how you do on them. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Around the wheel goes.
Another wheel. You spent your time making a lot of wheels.
Yes, I have.
Okay. I'm waiting with bated breath.
Okay. So your first question is, how many Oscars did the movie The Godfather win?
Oh, just Godfather 1, right?
Just Godfather 1.
That was early 70s. I know it was Best Picture. Did it get Actor? If it did, it would have been for Marlon Brando. Hold on. So I know it's movie. I'm pretty sure it's actor and director, maybe. So yeah, three.
Okay, it did win three, not the three that you mentioned, but it was nominated for 11 Oscars and it won only three. It won Best Picture, Best Actor for Marlon Brando, and it won Best Screenplay.
Okay, yeah, because it was based off of Mario Puzo's work. Gotcha.
That's right.
But didn't Coppola and Puzo actually work together to write that script?
I think the book came out at around the same time.
Well, yeah, the book came out, but then I think because Francis Ford Coppola is actually a screenwriter, but I think he worked with Puzo. He brought him in to work on the screenplay.
Yes. Yes. Well, have you seen the miniseries that came out last year about the writing of the Godfather?
No, I hadn't. So that's weird while you're thinking about that. And this always blows me away when it comes to the Oscars. And I don't, by the way, I haven't watched the modern Oscars in probably the last 15 years, because I don't think that they care anymore like they used to about actually finding the best films and the best actors and the best directors. But how is it that the guy who is responsible for adapting the work, getting the best picture as far as the win, getting, you know, actors who are just putting in a performance tour de force, how do you not recognize the director? This is crazy that he didn't win as director.
You're right. He didn't. Because that year, everyone thought Cabaret was going to win. Because Cabaret won 8 Oscars, you know, including Best Director. Yeah. So
I sometimes can't tell what Hollywood finds good and what they don't.
Yeah. No. Well, whatever. 2 years later, they made up for that with The Godfather 2. But yeah. So the miniseries that I was referring to was The Offer, which came out in 2022.
The Offer?
The Offer, yeah.
Okay.
You should check it out. It's pretty good. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I was right, but I was wrong because I got the wrong Oscar, but okay.
No, but you got the number. What was the question? The question was how many Oscars?
Right.
That you got. So, you can't be blamed for that.
Sure, I can. Ask my wife.
Yeah, but okay, I'm not going there.
But I'm bumped.
Not going there at all. All right, so let us spin the wheel again and see what the next question will be for Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it'll be a little harder.
Yeah, that was easy. This
okay.
Takes a while.
In the 1976 movie Rocky, what is the name of Rocky's trainer?
Mickey.
Okay, you know his last name?
Oh. Mick. Mickey. Hold on. I'm not sure. I don't know. I only think of him as Mickey and Mick. That's it. Just Mickey.
Okay, it's Mickey Goldmill.
When did they say that?
Well, it obviously is written on the in Rocky III. It's written on the tombstone.
On the tombstone.
my assumption is it's mentioned beforehand. You know. Obviously, you know who the actor is who plays him, right?
Right, Burgess Meredith. I can honestly tell you, until today, I had never known that there was a last name for Mickey. I didn't think about it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you still got it right. You got Mickey. So there you go. All right. So let's spin the wheel again and see what your next question is. And just so you know, you just missed when the wheel was going around, I just have to tell you this. It was on patent, and then it just moved slightly, and then you got the Rocky.
Oh.
You know, but we'll see. Maybe the patent question will come back, and maybe you'll be able to get it at that point.
And ironically, patent just barely makes the 70s since it came out in 1970.
But it's a movie. It's movies from the 70s, so it's from 1970 to 79. Okay, mm-hmm. How many Dirty Harry movies came out during the 70s?
Ooh. Oh, that's a good one, because Deadpool was the 80s. There's people going, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Ryan Reynolds, that wasn't the 80s. No, 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 there was the Deadpool.
The Deadpool, not just Deadpool.
Right. Well, we know the first one's called Dirty Harry. And then there was Magnum Force. And then there was the Enforcer. Was there another? Dirty Harry, Magnum Force, The Enforcer, The Deadpool, which is not in this. I'm probably missing one, but I can only think of three.
So what's your answer? Three or something else?
Three. I mean, I can only think of three.
Okay, and you were right. There are three.
Okay, because Sudden Impact was before Deadpool.
That's
that
right.
Was definitely early 80s, wasn't it? Sudden Impact?
Sudden Impact and the Deadpool are the two from the 80s.
Okay.
So, yes, you got the right. You got the three of them. Excellent. So it's Dirty Harry, Magnum Force. Dirty Harry in 1971, Magnum Force in 73, and the Enforcer in 76. All right, let's spin the wheel for your fourth question. Patton.
Come on, Patton.
No,
Joker,
you missed it.
Joker. No, Joker's wild.
You missed it.
You should have a wild, and then I can pick the category.
How would you pick it? It's like, it's, you know, it's a little difficult to pick a question on a wheel that's a wild card. You know, so.
Well, see, I know Patton's on there, so.
Yes. Oh, it's like, right, it stopped right before Patton. So it's a different one.
Okay. I think you're just saying that to mess with me.
I'm actually not.
I'm actually not.
1970 movie. The screenplay was written first. Then it was adapted into a novel, which was published before the movie was released and became a runaway bestseller from 1970. And it was written by Eric Segal.
Like Steven Seagal, but...
No, it's S-E-G-A-L, not S-E-A.
Oh. 1970.
Yes.
But it was okay. So the
screenplay
wrote
was written
the screenplay first.
Then
someone came along and made it a novelization.
No, no, no.
And
the same actor. Same writer. The same writer
decides to turn it into a book.
Yes.
And the book ends up coming out
before
the movie.
That's right. And it became a runaway bestseller, and therefore this movie became a hit and was nominated for Best Picture and a whole bunch of other Oscars also. Yes, so from 1970. And it's not Patton.
I was very young then.
I wasn't even around yet.
God bless. I don't know. I honestly don't.
All right, I'm going to give you a hint. It means never having to say you're sorry.
Oh.
That's the tagline for the movie.
Never been married?
Well, you're on the right. You're on the right track. It's a love story.
If you're never married, you'll never have to say I'm sorry.
That's yes, it's love. Love means you never have to say you're sorry.
You told me. I've never seen Love Story.
Well,
what's
yeah.
That about? Was that Ryan? Was that Ryan O'Neill?
Yes, it was Ryan O'Neill.
Yeah, I knew the name, and I've heard of the movie. I've never seen it. I know nothing about it other than I've heard the title, and I knew Ryan O'Neill was associated, but I've never seen it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's spin the wheel a final time and see if we finally get Patton. Let's spin the wheel.
All right. Yes, please. Can we move to... let's go to the last question, because I'm dying for this one. Although I did get the first three, so I'm okay. This is where I fail epically.
Okay, and once again, it went one beyond Patton. Yeah, this is just driving me nuts. I keep saying, okay, you're gonna get your Patton question, and you just don't get it. Shouldn't give me the Patton question and forget about what the wheel gave me? Is that what you really want?
It's totally up to you. It's your show. I'm just gonna tell you, if you ask me a Patton question and I get it wrong, I'd say I'm done. I'm just gonna be mentally checking out, and then you're gonna have to find somebody for Friday. Because
I
love that movie so much. I talk about it so much.
That's right.
Go ahead.
I will not ask the patent question then.
I want to know what the patent question is now.
The 1977 movie Star Wars won how many Oscars?
I know it's got a couple. It's got score, I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure that was John Williams. Who did he win though? Let me think. I mean, I'm going to guess. What did they call it? Because they didn't have best visual effects back then. Or did they? God, when did they start doing visual effects? So I think visual effects, there's no doubt. I know sound. I know John Williams. Got to be John Williams. I know editing for sure. Because the only thing that saved that movie was the edit. Four.
Okay, it won six. Of 10. Okay.
Okay.
It lost Best Picture. It lost Best Director. It lost Best Supporting Actor for Alec Guinness. And it lost Best Original Screenplay. It won Best Art Direction, Best Costume Design, Best Sound, Best Film Editing.
I got editing.
Best Visual Effects.
Okay.
And Best Score.
Okay. So I got, I did get four, and I knew what they were. I just didn't know costume and art direction.
Right. And in addition, it won a special achievement award for Ben Burtt for the sound effects.
Well, Ben Burtt is just the genius and pioneering new and innovative sound. I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
100%.
I remember as a kid watching like the behind the scenes and how he learned how to make the laser blasts and the, how he made the sound of the lightsabers by putting a microphone in front of like a radio and just kind of getting the feedback back. It was just really cool stuff.
Yes, I agree.
Like the I always remember this one from Raiders of the Lost Ark. The sound of that big stone when they're pulling it back, revealing where the Ark really is Ben Burtt's toilet lid being slid across the top of his toilet. It's like, how do you make that work? But you know, that's the genius that is the sound guy.
All right. And once again, we will go to the daily game of Name That Remake. So let's spin the wheel once again. And
we get another game?
Yes, you do.
Name That Remake. Well, I've gotten those have been all correct so far. So.
Right. Okay. So the original movie came out in 1965, and the remake was in 2004. And it's about a group of workers must find a way to survive after their plane crashes in the desert.
Oh, Dennis Quaid was in the remake, and it was Jimmy Stewart in the original. Is it Flight of the Phoenix?
Flight of the Phoenix. No. Very good. Flight Excellent.
Yes.
Nicely done. You've redeemed yourself.
Thank you. I needed it.
For not knowing about Love Story. There you go.
Right.
Exactly. All right. So, Alan, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Alan Sanders?
Sure. If you want to hear somebody talk about absolutely nothing, anything nonsensical. Actually, no, I do talk a lot about nonsense. It just happens to be in the world of politics. But you can find the Alan Sanders Show wherever you find podcasts. Just do a Google search or just do a search in your podcatcher of choice for the Alan Sanders Show. And you can find me there Monday through Friday, generally dropping by your commute time home, at least East Coast time, United States, so you can find out everything that you missed during the day.
Yeah, you can listen to it during rush hour.
During rush hour, when you're not going anywhere. We're not rushing.
That's right. Exactly. All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can send me an email to movierobminute@movierob.net. And you can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Instagram. So, Alan, do you feel like coming back again tomorrow for one more discussion of a minute of Palom 123?
Absolutely. Might as well close out the week at this point.
Excellent. All right. So, until tomorrow, at you.
All right. Oh, Gesundheit.